Welcome to this week's edition of the Android Developer Office Hours, coming to you from the top of the Android Developer Building in Mountain View, California, from Andy Rubin's old office. I have with me today in the studio Alex Lucas and Dan Galpin. And coming to you live from New York, it is, where is he? Roman Nurek.
Right.
There he is.
I feel it should be. It really should be live from New York. It's Roman Nurek.
Yes. Okay.
Which we're really glad because we have a representative of our group who understands user interfaces.
Yes. Exactly. He's our expert. First question comes to us from moderator. What happens if I tell my credit card company to cancel a payment I made via the Play Store? Does Google only get the money back from the merchant, or will my account be canceled? If you're the wrong people to ask, who should I ask?
What was the question again?
Okay, so if you ask your credit card company to cancel a payment that you made via the Play Store, I'm assuming.
Right. So I mean, you're actually talking not about canceling a payment because what you're really talking about in this case is you're claiming to your credit card company that somehow you were defrauded, because that's the only way you cancel a payment. And that creates something called a chargeback, and that's a pretty serious thing to do. If you're talking about actually canceling a payment, you're saying that you weren't delivered the service or good that you said was going to get delivered. That being said, Google Play has multiple ways for you to work with developers as well as with the Google Play store itself to resolve situations where you feel like you didn't get what you expected. So really, the credit, if you go through that route, it is a pretty serious thing to do. It's basically putting the question of both the developer and the store in jeopardy. So if I understand the question, that would be my answer. Don't do that. It's much better to try to resolve your disputes any other way, other than that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't see that earlier on the moderator page, so it was sort of a surprise.
Oh, okay.
So that's fine. That would be my feeling.
Okay. Unless we've got any other comments, I'm going to go back to moderator. And next question is, for security reasons, I need to ask a user to enter his username and password each time he launches the app. I'm planning to store it in app contacts so that it's accessible to all activities. Is there a better way to do this? Persistent storage is not an option.
So we talked about this. I mean, the app context is definitely a useful place to store things where you might otherwise store them in a singleton. If you don't want to create an application context just for that purpose, or override an application context for that purpose, you certainly are welcome to use a singleton inside of one of your classes. That will certainly work as well. But I think the application context is a reasonable way of doing it. And again, it's not any more secure than anything else. I think it's certainly a reasonable place to store that kind of data if it's going to be used within the session. So that jive with you guys? Any other comments on that?
I personally lean toward using a singleton just because I feel like overriding the application, like creating your own application class, is something that tends to get done incorrectly often and lead to all sorts of difficult to track down bugs. So I personally lean toward singleton. If you're comfortable actually overriding the application context and doing it that way, then yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean that's kind of what the application context is for, So it's kind of up to you, but you have multiple ways of attacking this problem, and I think they all have valid good reasons for doing them that way.
Okay, thank you. Do we have a question from someone in the Hangout? No. Okay. During the 2011 Google I/O, we were told that we'd hear more about Android at Home in the coming months, and that the first light bulbs would be sold by the end of 2011. The Android developer website still has no reference to it. What happened?
Well, there are a lot of light bulbs on sale right now. So I think that, in general, I went to the store and bought some just the other day. So I think the comment that the first light bulbs would be on sale before the end of 2011 certainly has happened, because I've managed to do that multiple times. You know, the truth is that that the coming months are still, there's still plenty more months, and we can't comment about things that have not been released.
It's a good point. It is a variation on the time machine question.
It is. That's true. Actually, we do have the
time machine.
I think it was phrased so as not to sound quite like a time machine question, mm-hmm. but it's still a what's going on with this thing that hasn't been released and we can't talk about.
I think we were being baited. I think they wanted to see what kind of creative answers we could come up with. The we can't talk about that answer.
Right.
And I wish we had something better to say.
Okay, let's move on. What is the best way to implement a quick action like widget in an ICS context? I mean, this is not an official way to do it in Android. What could replace it?
So I think I'd love to eventually defer to Roman on this one, but the answer is in terms of Android, we've moved away from that quick actions metaphor. As a general rule, if you look at what we've done in ICS in terms of contacts, we now actually display something that's more akin to a dialogue. It's actually a view that that pops up on top of the existing view for contacts and gives you a whole bunch of different options. That being said, if you really do like that paradigm, GreenDroid has a pretty good implementation of it, and that's certainly one place to look. But there really isn't some place in the framework I would look in terms of ICS, because that's something that we've pretty much deprecated as a UI concept, with the idea that having a little bit more space, I think, and giving the user a little bit more detail in those actions simplifies the experience. And so I think I really like the change we made to contacts in that. But certainly, if you're enamored with that, I would definitely look at GreenDroid. Do you have any comments on that, Roman?
Yeah, I just want to make sure, first of all, you guys can hear and see me.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. So so for quick contacts, that's definitely something that we've moved away from, that kind of that little pop-up with a little call, like triangular call-out to the anchor view. We've kind of moved away from that. And for quick contacts, like Dan said, we moved more towards this kind of transient pop-up that you can interact with. But for quick actions, which basically let you... just for those who aren't aware of the pattern, it basically let you take contextual actions like, for example, reply or star or delete or edit.
Very good point. Those go in the action bar.
Right. So basically, for contextual actions on items, we've moved more towards something called the contextual action bar. And so what happens is, if you're in a list of items and you want to allow the user to edit or delete one of those items, you basically trigger the contextual action bar by long pressing on one of the items. And the nice thing about the contextual action bar is that it can be used for both single and multiple selection. Now, on a mobile device, I mean, oftentimes you're doing stuff on single items, but I mean, there are definitely cases where you want to just batch process three things, four things, like batch archive emails, for example. And so to do that, the contextual action bar allows you to basically long press on the first and then single press on the other items you want to operate on and then trigger an action.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why we've moved away from quick actions. But if you do want to use quick actions, if you want to use kind of this anchored pop-up, you can use something like a pop-up window. But it's really like Dan and I have said, it's something that we've been moving away from.
So Roman, I had a question for you on this one. You know, what do we think about the sort of Gmail pattern of having a checkbox to switch into quick actions versus just the long press? Do we prefer one or the other? What's our current stance on that?
Yeah, I think that what we want is we want to train users to understand that long press means selection. Mm-hmm. And so having a checkbox there, and this is actually something that came up in a Friday review, mm-hmm. There are some apps that use checkboxes for different things. Like, for example, task lists. They use checkboxes to indicate that something is completed, right? So we don't want to drive the point that checkboxes mean selection. We actually want to use the activated state as well as kind of long press to indicate and to trigger selection. Another thing about Gmail, I think that one of the reasons they use checkboxes is that it's really kind of a legacy item from the desktop era. Well, not the desktop era, but from the Gmail desktop app, the web app. Since users are so familiar with checkboxes in Gmail on gmail.com, it kind of makes a lot of sense in that case, but I don't think it's something that generally applies.
Right. That's a good point.
Yeah, that's great. I just kind of wanted to clear, because I think a lot of people look at that application and say, well, this is how you implement quick actions, and I think that, I think as a general rule, that's sort of how not to implement quick actions.
I think if we were building Gmail from scratch with no web app, this is just my opinion. If we were building it from scratch, and we had started from the ICS version of Gmail and not had kind of legacy support for Brilliant Gingerbread and everything like that, we probably would not have Checkbox.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
We've actually got another question from the Hangout, from Elizabeth, if you want to cross over to her.
Yeah, hi. I had a couple of things that I wanted to talk about, actually. The first one is grid layout. I'm having some trouble understanding it. I posted a question to Stack Overflow and got a quick answer. Basically trying to make like a weighted layout. And so I've got four items. I divided the grid into 9 rows and 9 columns. And then my first item is at 1-1, my next item is at 1-5. But I'm finding that row 0 isn't there. There's no margins when I actually display it. There's no row 0 in the middle row. Well, it's a lot larger. It's not behaving as I expect, so I'm wondering if you have some more examples or documentation, and why, if I'm using explicit notation about spanning rows and columns, it's not really doing anything. I tried to throw a space in there in row 0, and that had no effect at all. So how does space work, and are there some more examples of grid layout?
So I think that the grid layout is one of those things I liken to. I kind of look at it almost like I'd be Perl, in the sense that it's something it's kind of the opposite of Perl. It's something that I think it's best to have machines write and not people write. It's pretty complicated. It's tricky to get all of its nuances right. It's incredibly powerful. But even internally, it's one of those things where when we're hand crafting layouts, we usually avoid using it. And obviously, that it's one of those things that just begs to have a tool to really work with well. I think that's kind of been our own internal look at it, is that it's this incredibly powerful system that if you use machines to build stuff, it actually makes a lot of sense. But I think it's tricky to handcraft them. And that's probably part of the reason why you're not seeing a lot of stuff from us. I'm hoping at some point in the future, someone will write a tool to do that. But I think that's kind of the issue with it. It's kind of a future thinking kind of layout. I don't know if anyone has any specific comments on her question.
Roman?
Yeah, I could add a couple of things there. So using the space, that was actually one thing I was going to mention, is if you're not using the space, then any row or column that has no items in it is not going to take up any space. Mm-hmm.
I put a space in and I had it span the whole, all 9 columns, but mm-hmm. it didn't change the appearance at all. I'm using the version 7, the backward compatible, because I'm trying to bridge Android right. 2 and Android 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so one thing you should make sure is that the spaces have like a fixed height or a minimum height. If they're wrapped content, then it'll not take up any space. But it is something that can be a little tricky. Like Dan said, it's best to leave to a tool. The last thing I want to mention, the first part of your question was around layout or weights. One of the caveats to using grid layout is that it's not currently the best thing to use if you want to have like kind of a percentage based layout. And one of the points in the documentation is that you can definitely combine grid layout and linear layout. That's so linear layout is really good for applying weights and kind of using percentages. Grid layout, not so much. So feel free to combine the two. Don't feel like you have to constrain yourself 100% to grid layout.
Yeah, the comment that I got from the team was that don't expect weights to really work within grid layout.
No, that's clear from the documentation. And this particular layout only has 4 items, so I probably will use weighted linear layouts with nesting, because performance with 4 objects on the screen is not going to be an issue.
No, not at all.
Right. I wanted to practice with it. I wanted to try it. I have a Proto, an Adobe tool on my tablet, and it does layouts in exactly this fashion. But mm-hmm. when I, when I tried to put it into practice and span some rows and columns, and it, right. I didn't find it was working as I would expect.
Well, I think
so. Additional documentation, additional examples would really be valuable.
Right. Are you using it for? Can you describe quickly the specific problem that you're trying to solve with it? Do you have one, or?
Yeah, so I have four buttons, and I want them centered on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
They're equal size, and, you know, I don't want them top left. I want them to show up in the middle.
Yeah, usually the way I solve that problem is by using weighted layouts and linear layouts, and I put empty views in.
Yeah, but that's my point. I want to learn grid.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay.
Grid. I want to figure
Understood.
Out how it works, and it's not working as I expect.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely, and I think that's awesome. You're working with it. I mean, I think from our perspective, by putting it into the V7 support library, you know, we're really committed to it. We want people to start being able to use it. I think it's just a question of getting to the point where, you know, again, we have the tools and documentation to really support it. But
I can't quite find the tags, right? Some of the tags are prefixed grid. Some of them are prefixed Android. I'm getting a little lost in it. And if there were additional pointers or sites that I should check.
Yeah, I think there'll be more to come. I mean, that's from my perspective. Once we've gone and put it in the support library, I think that it's our intention to support it. So I'm hoping that you'll see more. I wish we had more right now.
Cool. There was one more thing I wanted to talk about. Please, go ahead.
We will note that, I think everybody agrees that we need to have more written up about grid layout. We definitely support it, and it's hard for people to use, so we'll have to look at it some more. Go ahead.
I have a second problem I wanted to ask some advice about. I've got, like I said, I'm bridging Android 2 and Android 4.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the Android 2 devices are, normal size screens and smaller density. So I've got a text view, and, you know, I'm setting it up to ellipse size. Now, I want to let the user be able to maybe touch it if the text is truncated and somehow or other view the full content in the smaller screen sizes where the text view is getting truncated. Do you have a good strategy for that, like handling ellipsized text and then, you know, being able to display the full content in some way or another?
Is there a good pattern for that, Roman, in terms of, you know, something that we've exposed, we've talked about?
Not that I'm aware of. The only, and this is kind of a stretch, but the only thing that I have seen that's even relevant to this, I think, is in terms of interaction, if you have a text view that, let's say, is three lines, right, three lines of text, and you only see two lines of text, if you mark the text view as text is selectable, if you give it that attribute, and now this is obviously going to make text selectable, so you'll have a contextual action bar to copy and paste. If you do that, if you have that attribute, not only is the text selectable, but the text is also scrollable.
Yeah.
Right.
So you can actually just scroll it up and down. Now that may be you may be able to get this behavior through another attribute. I'm not sure if that exists. I know that obviously you can put a text view in a scroll view and that works, but I'm not actually sure if you can do that without using text as selectable. But if anything, the interaction that you'd probably be going for is upon touching, you kind of enable scroll. But I don't think we have any cases in even in like the Google Play client, which does a lot of marquee scrolling or ellipsizing. I don't think we have many cases where we are allowed that.
Yeah, there's a few times where I've really wanted that. So, you know, that's why I was curious if, you know, what our current view on that as a pattern was concerned. I mean, if it's really, really important, you could always, allow the user to click on it and pop something up too. That would be the other acceptable pattern. As long as you make it clear that it's a click target, you know, that might also be reasonable. But I think getting it to scroll would be the best of the worlds, and I like the idea of making it selectable in general.
Okay. Any other comments?
Love the tiara.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for your help. The tiara makes me smile, so I'm happy with you.
Good.
I would like to see more people in our hangouts doing interesting things like that.
Right.
So.
That's
good.
Awesome.
Thank you very much for your questions.
I'll talk to you again.
Yep. Next question coming up off of moderator is, I'm currently learning Android via the new Boston's.com collection of 200 videos, Mon Video 120, and it's been great. That's pretty good.
Wow.
Anyone know of any other video tutorials or a must-read book for a beginner? I'm working on an app for my final project at school.
I don't know of any videos specifically. I know that I have in the past learned other technologies off of lynda.com, and they always had some really pro like developer videos. In terms of books, let's see.
We do have published. We have a published author in the room here.
Right. our producer, Rado Meyer, has a book out on Android 4 development that you can find on Amazon.
Yeah. It's really nice, too, in the sense that it's been really thoroughly updated for Android 4.
He's not allowed to promote it, I think, or he chooses not to because of conflict of interest, but I think it's a really good read, so
yeah,
I've got no problem saying it's definitely worth looking at.
Yeah, it's a really good text, and I think it's one of the very few that you can really get the latest stuff on Android from that's been updated to that level. So it's as far as video tutorials are concerned, you know, I think that I haven't looked at the 200 that are on that site, but that sounds pretty awesome. And you know, from our perspective, you know, keep watching, and we'll hopefully you'll learn something from these as well.
Yeah, I did want to point out also that we have Android University classes up on developer.android.com, mm-hmm. which go through very specific tasks in doing Android development. Those might be worth looking into as well.
Yeah, we should make videos out of all of those because I think some people like ingesting content as videos, mm-hmm. so that would be cool.
It's a good idea. Okay, moving forward, our next question is there a way in, let me double check this, looks like that's it. Is there a way in Google Play to provide a paid version of an app or in-app purchase to certain users for free via coupon code or something? If not, is there a recommended way to do this?
Okay. So there isn't a way that's built directly into Google Play. One of the team members that we were talking about this before the Hangout was suggesting, like, one option that you have is to set up a billing server as your own independent server, and then set it up so that when you do in-app billing, what that essentially does is contact your billing server and say, this user paid for this item. And then what you can do is set up a coupon system within your app so that the user enters a coupon, and that would also go to your billing server and also say, like, that this user has this item. So you would need, basically, you'd be setting up an external authority on which users have access to which in-app purchases instead of just going through Google Play, but it would be really easy to build the coupon mechanism into that.
Yeah, as a general rule, if you're using unmanaged transactions on Google Play, you're going to want to set up an external authority in order to manage them, and that allows you to do a lot of things. You know, one is that you can make sure that those purchases go from device to device, because, you know, with an unmanaged transaction, ultimately you're responsible for doing all of that. But the answer is there's no way currently to do it within Google Play where it'll do the work for you with managed transactions. One caveat is if you are going to put together your own coupon system, you do want to make sure you don't go afoul of policies on Google Play in terms of monetization. So I think if you're giving away coupon codes, that's one thing. But do be cautious of and make sure that you're reading the terms of service for Google Play as a developer and the content policies.
Good. To follow up on that, the actual next question is, what's the recommended way to manage different incarnations of an app, like ad-free, and beta-limited users on Play? If multiple APKs, what's the best way to build different configurations of the same app?
To head that one off at the pass, multiple APKs are not the solution for this one.
Right.
Multiple APKs, for those who aren't familiar, multiple APKs let you create different APKs that fall under the same Google Play listing, so there's only one listing, one URL for people to go to. And behind the scenes, Google Play will sort of pick the APK that is appropriate for your device. But it's limited in the way it lets you divide those up. So basically, you can only use the multiple APK feature if each APK is different from one another in at least one of GL textures, screen size, or a minimum SDK version supported. Since none of those involve in-app billing, like it's not something that would work for you.
Yeah, as a general, I mean, what's great about multiple APK is that if you want to, you know, you've got a version of your app that you've built and it's really awesome and it works on Donut, and you just decide today that you're not seeing enough Donut users that it makes sense to continue testing on Donut, you can fork your app, you can keep that version available to those Donut users, and you can start targeting Ice Cream Sandwich. And you know, that's really awesome. I think that's its best use, honestly. You know, you still want to make your app available. You still care about those users, but you don't care about them enough to continue developing an app for them. in terms of how to deal with a title that has multiple incarnations, I mean, I think that for the most part, it's great if you can have one title that can use in-app billing to change between ad supported or ad free. That being said, having a premium version of the title is also cool. You can do a lot because you can actually use any two applications that are signed with the same signature and conceived together can actually share information. And so you can make sure that if the user does buy the premium version of the app, if you do have two listings, that it actually upgrades very seamlessly. They both can share the same data, whether that's through a content provider or whether that's actually through just literally using shared resources within the app. One way or another, you can make that happen really, really well for the user and in a very seamless way. So that would be the way I would go. You could even go so far as you buy the paid version of the app, it triggers something that actually makes a change in the other version of the app. You've got all sorts of options there. But the best thing to do would be to make sure that whatever content they created or preferences they had in the free version just were carried over to the paid version, and that's pretty straightforward to do. So that would be my guidance there. The advantage of having both versions is, of course, if your app is really, really popular, you might end up getting into top paid or top new paid. That would be the reason to have it. The reason not to have it is obviously you have a lot fewer downloads if you're dividing them across multiple listings. So it can work for you or against you. And there are certainly apps where it's worked for them, and I would say there's certainly apps in which it's worked against them.
Okay. Thank you very much for your comment.
Yeah, sure.
Let's see. The next one I want to go to here is to move away from the market for a second. is there a way to specify an OR attribute in a resource folder name? That is, I want to use the same layout files for both layout large and layout SW600DP without having to manually keep all the files in the two folders in sync.
No. And...
However,
I'm glad that the answer is no, because that would be a maintenance nightmare if you think about it. The workaround is that for your particular situation, like a workaround is to put a values.xml file in, like across each of these different things, so like a values.xml or like in the what's the folder?
Is a values.
Res values.
Res/values-large and res/values-sw600, and in there specify the file names for the pictures that you want to be loaded, and then just dump all of your pictures for all of your resolutions in the just main drawables folder.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry, I just wanted to make one extra comment. There's an Android training article called Designing for Multiple Screens, and I think in the Supporting Multiple Screen Sizes lesson in that class or article, there's a section on layout aliases, and that's exactly what we're referring to here. So that might be a nice kind of snippet.
This is
an
Android University class, right, Roman?
Yep, Android training. That's right.
Okay,
Android
good.
Training.
Right.
Roman knows the good answer to that one.
I got to run, but it was a pleasure seeing y'all.
Thank you, Roman.
thanks for being here. Now you're stuck with just us.
Right.
Okay, we're going to go back to handling marketing and Google Play. Just for a sec. Because it's important to developers,
here.
Right? Well, we need to. It would be good to get some Google Market, Google Play Store people in here. After recently finishing an Android app, I'm faced with a pricing dilemma. Assuming I charge $1.99, What's the best way to market my app, in your opinion? The CPC/CPM programs I've tested do not yield anywhere near break-even. And he says AdMob, AdWords, and FB.
Well, you know, I think that we're not going to try to say that there's one marketing strategy that fits all applications. You know, I think that's the first thing. Obviously, when we talk about how to market, you want to first start off with making sure that you have really good assets in Google Play. You want to make sure that your featured banner is awesome, that looks professional, especially if you're going to be charging for your app, because that just means that there is a little bit of a barrier there. People have to feel very confident that your app is going to rock before they're going to buy it. And so we focus on a great YouTube video, we focus on great marketing assets within the store. So the goal being, of course, that when you're actually driving someone to that page within the Google Play Store, you really want to make sure that you're going to generate the maximum click-through and the maximum number of purchases. And also making sure in the ad that it's really clear that, you know, that this is an app that they are going to have to pay for, so you're not getting a lot of false clicks. They know what they're getting into, I think is useful. That being said, you don't really have a lot of control over precisely how your ad is displayed, so that is an issue. The next thing I would say is really make good use of analytics. You want to find out, you want to use the Google Analytics on Google Play that give you access to which campaign generated your clicks. And then you can play with it. Then you can say, I'm going to do a small ad purchase. See, are those converting? Am I seeing any results? And I think that allows you to experiment with things. I think that's what's kind of wonderful about the internet and advertising. We know that for some people, those ads are very, very valuable. And so I think you have to figure out, you know, what assets are going to convert, what you need to do in your app to make it convert, to make sure you get really high ratings and get people really excited about it. And then honestly, try different strategies. Make sure that you're, of course, utilizing every free possible method of promotion you can. Is also important. So I don't know, do you have anything to add to that? Or?
Yeah, a little bit. Good. For off the top of my head, the free methods of promotion, every Friday we have app and game reviews that you can submit your app to.
Good point.
And we will live on the air, play with your application, and tell you what we like and don't like about it, like room for improvement and stuff like that. Yeah. And in the past, quite a few apps have gone from being evaluated on the air in this sort of... Mm-hmm. In this thing that we have set up, like two being featured on Google Play. So, you know, submit your app and like we'll look at it and people will watch us look at it. So free promotion.
And also, you know, hopefully we'll give you some ideas on how to make the app better. I mean, that's you know, and if, and that's, I think that's it's pretty cool to get on here with some people like Roman who really know what they're doing. And can be are very helpful. So that's really exciting.
Great.
I would real quick, just to elaborate on the what Dan was saying about analytics. I can't emphasize this enough. There's a big difference between looking at how much money you paid for advertising and how many dollars you got in revenue, to looking at, you know, which locales where people click on links versus which locales your app is available in, like how many people on like different websites, how much you paid, like what keywords you're using. And if they map, like, which keywords that you use map to people actually clicking and purchasing your app and, you know, not spending money on all the keywords that don't convert at all. Like, look at some data. If you drop $100 on advertising and pay 10 cents a click, that is 1,000 click-throughs that you can break apart and look at and get a good idea of what works and what doesn't.
Okay.
We have a question from Ed Burnett on the stream. He wants to know, do you recommend multi-APK for handling multiple architectures, say ARM versus x86, for example?
We do not support multiple APK for that at the moment. I think it's a great feature request. But currently today, you can the way things work is you do incorporate every single one of those binaries that you wish to support into your app, and then Android does the correct thing and makes sure that the correct library gets open based upon the directory that's used to store it. I think in the future, obviously, you know, we now have two ABIs that are that have a lot of use. We know that x86 is coming along. We know they're MIPS devices. I think as we see more of these, it makes more sense to include that into multiple APK. But currently, that is not a vector. You cannot use it. And in fact, if you try to use it, you will find that the system will actually restrict you to the application to the minimum ABI set. Basically, it does exactly the opposite of what you want it to do. So basically, don't use it for that yet.
Okay, good to know. Moving on in moderator, after uploading an app to Google Play and saving it as a draft, is it possible to allow one or more select people to download it for testing? He wants to do this before hitting publish.
No, not through Google Play. What you can do, if it's a situation where, for instance, you want to be testing LVL or in-app billing, what you do is you upload the APK as a draft to Google Play, and then you distribute that exact same APK to all of your team members through some other vector, like email, or put it on a website on a private server, or just let them ADB it down. But it's not possible to download a draft from Google Play.
It's a great feature request, though.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Back to some coding. Is there a way to detect an orientation change when an activity's screen orientation is set? In other words, we want our activity to detect when the device is in landscape so we can rotate some images, but we want our activity to stay in portrait.
So you can definitely use the accelerometer APIs. I'm trying to think, is there an orientation listener that's independent? I'm trying to remember if there's actually... I don't think we don't actually have any accelerometer gestures supported, so I think you'd be responsible for that. Certainly applications do that. You can also... it's a very good question. I'm not sure what the best practice is to that. So
I don't think we have anything that'll say, like, you're in landscape now or you're in portrait if your screen is locked.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it will say... Yeah. I mean, we do have the one that says, like, you are tilted 45 degrees to the left or to the right from whatever the native orientation of the device is.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess the... yes, you can do that. So you could just use that, and that's what developers do use, is they use that API to decide whether they're going to rotate or do whatever within their application. But yeah, there's no not kind of built-in way to say I'm at this orientation, but you can look at the tilt. So it's pretty close.
Yeah. If you're in the Hangout, I'm actually curious what the use case for this is. Like outside of a compass or something, I can't picture like how this is getting used. But if you're not, that's cool too.
Okay, thank you. The pre-ICS alert dialog that Builder automatically added padding around the custom view. However, in ICS, it does not do this. Is there a way to make the padding around the custom alert dialog view consistent both pre- and post-ICS?
The answer, I guess that in general, the answer to this is no. I think that if you look at the Holo UI, there's all sorts of places where spacing has changed, and I think that it's kind of we've radically changed the way Android looks, and hopefully if you want to really support that, the way to do that is to create a layout that looks really great in ICS, and to make a slightly different layout that looks great in Gingerbread. The other thing you can do, however, if you're just concerned about padding, what I would actually do is go back to the thing we talked about earlier, and you can actually create an attribute, and this is actually how I've solved this particular issue, an attribute that has a value of 0 on Gingerbread and a value that matches what change you want to see on ICS, and then you can just set your padding to that, or your spacing to that, and then it will, it'll make that slight change if you don't actually want to create a different layout. But kind of as a general rule in ICS, you're going to want to create different layouts. A lot of things have changed. And example that I always use is the progress bar is now really tiny on ICS. And so you might not want to have it take up as much space. You might want to adjust the layout around it. And it allows you to make much more optimal use of space, but at the same time, more optimal. But at the same time, you also have to... It does mean if you want it to look the best on ICS, you're actually going to want to make sure you're testing it on an ICS and looking at it in those
right.
in the emulator. So.
Okay, great, thank you. Next question from moderator: what's the best way to handle the Web Chrome client's on-show custom view to allow flash videos to play in full screen mode. This applies to cases like, and then there's a link to Stack Overflow question about flash player crashing when trying to enter full screen mode in Android 4.
I do not know the answer to this one off the top of my head.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think when I first heard that, you know, it reminded me that we actually that Chrome refers to not just a browser, but it also refers to the thing in the browser that actually displays things like controls for the user. It's a good question. It's also kind of these days. I think that using Flash Player within a web view within your app is definitely pushing the platform in ways that I think are not necessarily desirable. There's a lot of stuff that all has to work right that isn't necessarily designed to all work together in that way. So it's one of those things you definitely approach with caution. If you're going to want a really, really good native experience, it's probably better to use native formats when you can. To avoid layer upon layer of stuff, but that being said, I don't know the answer to this one. So,
okay, thank you. Next question: are there any third-party libraries for synchronizing application data, SQLite databases, with the cloud, or do I need to implement an App Engine backend myself?
I don't know of any third-party libraries off the top of my head. In the common sys moderate question, it is mentioned that CouchDB is working on one called TouchDB, which is a NoSQL, a document-based database. They're working on adding this to Android. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for specifically SQLite database syncing mechanism, I'm not aware of any. That doesn't mean they don't exist. Android is a popular platform, and we cannot keep track of all the awesome things that people build for it. We try, but there's a lot. So, do you happen to know them?
You know, I'm not going to discourage you from building an App Engine backend. I think that's a perfectly reasonable way to approach the problem. But what you probably want is some tool that allows you to determine, really the diff between what you have on the backend and what you currently have in the device, and does something intelligent. So really, I look at the back end as being very simple. I look at making sure that you actually have sync parity between the two to be the best. If you're sending the least amount of information is usually the challenge, and making sure that those things are up to date is a challenge. I think that's the interesting piece. If you're syncing a small amount of data and you don't really need true sync, then just writing an app engine backend that dumps what's inside of your app is pretty simple and straightforward. So it really kind of depends on your use case.
Yeah. I would add that I'm not really sure what's being asked here. I know that we include a sample application in the SDK called Sample Sync Adapter, which is basically an implementation of a sync adapter for the contacts provider, which is a content provider that's included with the platform, and that gives you some idea of how to do synchronization between data that's on a client device and data that's in the cloud. And it also shows you how to set up a sync adapter, which you definitely would want to try, at least if you're going to be doing synchronization. And the reason I say that is because as Dan pointed out, first of all, there's the issue of, well, how do you deal with differences between the device and the cloud? Secondly is, how do you make sure that when you want to do a synchronization that you're doing it at an appropriate time on the device, that you've got a network connection and all sorts of other things that you have to worry about when you're doing this? And Sample Sync Adapter will point all of those out to you. So those are some other comments that I'd like to add.
Cool.
We have another question from the Hangout.
Go for
it. Awesome.
Yes, sir. Hello?
We cannot hear you.
We're still waiting for audio. Hold on.
That seems like we can't hear him, so I think we'll move on.
Okay.
Okay.
He can type his question in, right?
He could type his question in, or otherwise we can't hear what he's saying. So
right now,
we'll move on for the moment. We haven't forgotten you.
Sorry.
Next question from moderator is, I was wondering how to do a progress view over the bottom of the action bar like Google Chrome for Android does when it's loading a page.
So the answer is that Google Chrome is not using an action bar. They're using a custom view. I wish there was a way to do that in an action bar. But unfortunately, if you look at what Chrome is actually doing, what you're thinking of as an action bar is really actually the Chrome within Google Chrome, and that's just a custom view. It's a really nice pattern. I think it looks really good on ICS, especially with the new thin progress bar that we have in ICS, but it is not part of the standard action bar control pattern that we have. So you can do it by implementing a custom view. You could even do it right at the top of your view. That would look similar to what Chrome has done, but you know, Chrome actually does overlap the bottom of that top view, and the only real way to do that easily is to do it inside of your code. You could, in theory, actually do a pop-up window and have it pop up on top of that space, I believe, and that would actually work. There are ways you might be able to overlay that on top of the action bar, but there's certainly no built-in pattern to do that.
Right. Thank you, Dan. Moving on, curious what the status is of reducing audio latency in the Android media libraries. This has been talked about at a number of I/O conferences and is listed as the number 2 bug under defects. It's number 3434.
It's good to know that people are enthusiastic about audio. I work with a lot of game developers We're always trying to make Android feel as interactive as possible. I think a lot of that has to do with things like audio latency. We have nothing new to report on that, but we do see those bugs, and so I know that there are people here who are really passionate about audio who would like to see that addressed.
Okay.
Okay. Let's give another try for the Hangout.
Go ahead.
All right.
I need to do a two-way slider that, you know, you move it from, you can move one from left to right and one from right to left, that it will be on the same place on the screen.
So they're split in half so that you can move the top one to the right and the bottom one to the left, something like that?
No, it would be on the same line, not one below and one above. Like, you've got one, you can move it so you can choose two options, you know, to give it a set of limits if you want to set, like, let's say some kind of amount of something, and you set the top one and the lowest one, and it should be on the same line.
Right. So you'd have basically two pucks that are sitting on the same line.
Yes.
Okay.
That looks like a really good case for a custom control,
right?
And it's pretty easy to actually make a widget track the user's movement, and there's lots of really great examples. In terms of when I say widget, I mean a piece of widget track the user's motion. But it is something that you're either gonna have to find some code out there that does, or that you're gonna have to do yourself. But I love the idea of a custom control kind of in general. It's really pretty straightforward to set up. You can create, properties of your own, even in XML, so you can really easily dump the control into places. But I think that's pretty much what you're going to be stuck with doing. Are there specific aspects of doing that kind of custom widget that you're interested in, or do you have other ideas in mind for how you might implement this?
Well, I just need to do it based on the. A mission that I got from work to do, so I got a specific implementation they want me to do.
Right. Mm.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely take a look at, as you're implementing, also definitely look at the Android design guidelines, because it'll give you ideas on spacing, and you can really make it feel like it's part of the platform a lot with that. So that's just kind of a general, especially whenever you're doing anything custom, referring to kind of our general grid that we use, I think is really, really useful. That would be my suggestion. But yeah, it's definitely a good use for a custom control.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we have one more question from Andrew, who's also on the Hangout, who wants to follow up on a question he asked in moderator.
Go ahead.
Sure. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I asked a few questions in moderator, including the one about orientation change.
Right.
I just wanted to follow up on that because you asked what the purpose was. And
right.
We have a lock screen replacement application, and so when you turn the phone sideways, we want the icons on the sliders to rotate, but we want to keep the application in portrait and not change the layout, if that makes sense.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So we want to be able to detect that orientation change without having... I figured we could probably do something with the accelerometer, but I don't want to have to be polling, especially if it's a lock screen application. I want to be notified in some way that the orientation has changed.
Well, if the lock screen is actually active, you can definitely turn on the sensor, and you know, it'll give you the data. It's not really a question of polling at that point. You're not concerned usually about battery while the lock screen is active and the device and the screen is powered on. And like, you know, it's obviously a lock screen replacement is not something that's really supported by the framework at all. So you're kind of in just kind of crazy territory there anyways. So you've got to be really, really careful. But yeah, that I don't think there's any particular reason not to turn the accelerometer on if your window is currently active and the device is powered on. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. You just have to make sure that when it's not powered on, when your screen is not longer active, that you turn it off.
Right.
So,
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Moving back to the moderator. How can action bar compat be extended to allow changing the visibility of menu items at runtime on pre-ICS devices? It says there's Stack Overflow action and action bar compat, how to change visibility of actions at runtime on P.
It should be pretty straightforward. I mean, I think that... So you're talking about the actions that are actually part of the bar, because everything in the action bar compat overflow gets shoved into the standard menu, and that's really just... that just gets updated... if it's not getting updated already, basically the way it should work is that your application, you know, gets asked for which menu items are currently present, and you give that list back, and the ones that are flagged as being in the action bar actually show up there, and the ones that are not show up in the overflow menu, which is just the standard menu in action bar compat. So that should actually work. Is there actually a bug where is he referring to a bug where this is actually not working with when the menu options change, that it's no longer, that it's still showing up in the action bar?
I'm not really sure. I'd have to go take a look at that.
Yeah, so I think the way action bar compat works is it's actually just a big layout, and what we do is as menu items are added, it actually goes and adds them to that layout. So my theory is if you made a change to the which menu items were visible, that you just have to remove all the children from that and clear that out, and then recreate it. I don't think there's anything that prevents you from doing that. But I have to go look at the source code for action bar compat. That's what I vaguely remember it doing. So Roman would know exactly what it does. I think that's what you'd have to do, is just clear out those children and have it recreate itself when those menu items change. And what I would probably do is just have something in the code that detects that those menu items change, so it knows when it has to rebuild, just to prevent you from doing that all the time. We could probably make that a pretty easy change that's pretty efficient.
Okay.
So, does that seem reasonable to guys?
Yeah.
So I think that's what's going on, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Next question. Is there a proper way to use Search Recent Suggestions Provider with an autocomplete text view? I'm using Search View with a custom interface similar to Google Plus search activity. on SDK above 3.x and autocomplete text view for 2.x.
So this is a question I didn't completely understand, because it sounds to me like you've solved the problem, but in the sense that you have a 2.x solution and a 3.x solution. Is the issue that you want to have the same view, or is there some property that you're getting from the 3.x version from the 2.x version that you want the 3.x version to have? So I guess I'd love to get more information on precisely what you want here, because it's definitely interesting. I'm not particularly familiar with the new 3.x stuff. So we'll definitely have to get back to you and get some more information, I think, to figure out what exactly you want to do in this question. That was kind of, you know, we got a little stumped.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Let's see. I think this is probably going to be about the last question we can take. It'll come from moderator. The question is, can you discuss what the specific advantages are of using ICS as a target SDK on a Honeycomb Min SDK app?
So probably the biggest... on a Honeycomb Min SDK using ICS as a target, well... as a general rule, it's best to always use the most recent version that you've tested on as the target. And there's a lot of things that happen in terms of specific between Honeycomb and ICS.
It gets rid of the legacy manual on
ICS phone devices, because the assumption is that on tablet devices it will for Honeycomb, but I think for phone devices you actually need to target ICS. Most of the time, like, I'll give you some examples. There are specific compatibility tweaks that are made, for example, in JNI code that are done for different versions of Android. So, and those are typically performance related. Occasionally, there's emulation and backwards compatibility stuff that's thrown in that will not give you slightly lower performance if you're not targeting the latest SDK. So there is stuff that the system does to try to maintain a wider range of compatibility. So it's always best if you can target the latest. I think that there may be certain aspects of Hollow that you can take advantage of only with target SDK 14 as well, but I'm not completely sure. But as a general rule, if you're going to target ICS, you're going to end up with the best running application on ICS, and there's really, if you're testing already on ICS, there's really fairly limited reason to not target it. So I think that's probably the best answer. But I'd love to get more specifics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, Mr. Producer, do we have time for one more?
We do have Andrew on the Hangout who wants to follow up on a question he had last week. So if we've got a moment, let's see if he can.
Okay,
sure.
Go ahead.
Sure,
and do that.
Yeah, that's right. You had multiple questions.
Hello again, Andrew.
Hi,
Andrew.
You're muted.
So is that us or is that? Wait.
Ask me again.
Try again.
Go ahead. Hello.
Oh.
Still muted.
One of us is muted.
There. How about now?
Okay,
oh,
yes.
That's better.
All right, so I had a question a few weeks ago about the status bar at the bottom on tablet devices and how the back button and the home button and on the left side and the time on the right side is interfering. So in this particular app situation I'm talking about, it's a handwriting note-taking app, so you're actually writing on the screen. So your arm, if you're right-handed, rests on the bottom right part of the screen and then causes the users to open up the status or the notification part, and left-handed users often hit the back button. So I'm wondering if there's a way, I asked a few weeks ago, if there's a way to make that go away, make the status bar hidden and bring it back some other way. And the response was, in Ice Cream Sandwich, there is that capability, but as soon as you interact with the screen, it comes back.
Yeah, and actually, in Ice Cream Sandwich on tablets, it won't actually make it go away, but it will very nicely make it stop interacting for one click. You know, honestly, if this is a really important feature to your app, I would do something a little crazy, and I would actually... it all depends. If you're using the framework, this is tricky. You could render your app upside down and force them to, and that's one way of doing it. And fix the orientation, but actually render the app upside down, which will put the action bar on the top. If handwriting is really, really important, that's one way of doing it. Obviously, there's not a lot of support for that. You can definitely use if you're targeting, ICS and Honeycomb, you can actually use some of the properties to rotate everything to make sure that everything's actually turned upside down when it's being laid out. So that's one way of doing it. Honestly, that's a lot of work. I don't think there's a good way to just rotate the display. For a game, if you were a game developer and you were actually just using OpenGL, it's really trivial. It's a little harder when you're actually writing an app. But if you're doing a custom view for a lot of it, then it might be easy. But that at least gets that on the top. The other option, of course, would be to use portrait mode and put it onto the side. Because obviously your app isn't technically required to render itself matching. And your case is one of those weird random cases in where it might actually make more sense to not actually use the default orientation. Obviously, not every device in the world can be rotated. Some devices are an HDMI. This is something that's definitely on the side of hacky. But if it's really required to prevent people from touching that bar during handwriting, it might actually make sense for your app.
Is there a way to with an activity to just say, right, make this activity draw upside down?
No, that's the thing. There's a lot of work involved with this. There are ways to flip a canvas around, and you could actually, basically in OnDraw, when you first get the canvas, you could perform a transform on it that would probably do most of what you wanted it to do. You could certainly play with that, but then your touches are all going to be off. You have to make sure you're also transforming all of that. It would be tricky, and it's kind of hacky. That's the only way I can think of doing it in a compatible way. At least it gets it off out of the user's way. But that is the one issue with having that there.
Right.
Is it if you are resting your hands on it, you could accidentally touch it.
If I could make a suggestion, one of the things that I thought of just for future development is if there could be a way to actually... I know part of the problem with having an app be allowed to tell that to disappear is that then the user on devices that don't have buttons have no way of doing anything anymore.
Right.
They have to trust that app. But if there would be... I think... every device has to have a power button. So just an idea I've had is to allow the app to make the status bar go away and the navigation bar go away and have the power button, press to the power button, bring it back, or some variation on that.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of ways in which this could solve. You could allow the user to lock the bar. You could allow the user to move the bar to the top of the screen themselves, configure the device. I think that those are all things that have advantages and disadvantages. The power thing, certainly has been discussed, and I would love to see something like that happen. But I think that for the vast majority of applications, the advantage of always having a consistent way to get out of it over is more important than the cases in which it doesn't help. And I think the key thing is just to try to make sure we service those cases better and going forward. I definitely see both sides of this issue, and they've been certainly hotly discussed internally. This theory, we're not unaware of that. But I think that right now the general feeling is that giving the users that confidence that they always have the ability to back out and always have the ability to go home and switch apps is outweighs the benefit of being able to move it around and the accessibility of that feature as well. The best thing I can come up with now is to use the trick that you can lay out your app that in a way that doesn't actually match the screen orientation. But it's not a perfect solution, I agree.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Andrew. Looks like we've run over for today. We've been having so much fun. So I'd like to thank you all for sending your questions in. I'd like to thank our experts here for joining in and trying to give answers, and to Roman, who's in New York, and to our producer, Rito Meyer. And we will see you again next week.